From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. A former Bay Area Rapid Transit police officer in Oakland, California, has been charged with the murder of an unarmed black man. Oscar Grant III was shot in the back as he lay face down on a train platform on New Year's Day. Alameda County District Attorney Tom Orloff made a rare decision to file a murder charge against a police officer for an on-duty incident. He explained why at a press conference yesterday.
Murder charges were filed because at this point, what I feel the evidence indicates is an unlawful killing done by an intentional act. And from the evidence we have, there's nothing that would mitigate that to something lower than a murder.
The officer in question, 27-year-old Johannes Messerly, was arrested in Nevada. His attorney, Christopher Miller, says he expects Messerly to be cleared of all charges once the night's events become clear. John Burris is the attorney for the victim's family. He recounted the family's response to the latest developments.
For the mom, she's been very saddened, of course, and she's certainly in deep mourning. And her response was, "That's very good, but it doesn't bring my son back." So there's certainly a large degree of elation in the family, and that this process at least has started.
John Burris is the attorney for the victim's family, and he is someone who is tracking this very carefully. For more, we have a look at protests in Oakland following Oscar Grant shootings, including one just last night. Some shops were damaged. Many business owners are wondering what are going to happen next. Joining me now, we've got Reverend Eltina McCree. She runs a clothing store on 17th Street, one of the areas affected by the demonstrations. Welcome to News and Notes.
Greetings.
So there were more demonstrations last night. What is the scene like this morning?
Well, it's just like it was last Wednesday, a cleanup scene. Merchants in the central part of town, city center, where the 12th Street BART station is located, were hit last night. And, of course, Wells Fargo Bank and a number of our other beloved food or places were hit last night, and you saw it, of course, on TV. You saw it as it was happening. So, you know, it's just cleanup this morning, and our spirits are down.
When you say your spirits are down, that must be an understatement. I mean, what kind of conversations are you having right now with your neighbors and with other people who are in the community trying to bring people together?
Well, I'm literally, people, of course, have come up to me. The riot last week, the vandalism last week, centered on 17th Street, which is where I'm located. And I represent the South of Broadway 17th Street merchants. And so I've been very verbal for this whole time. And the sad part of it is that they're asking me for kind of direction this morning, and I feel empty. Yesterday, the protest, the rally, Derica Blackman actually called me about 3 o'clock and sent me a couple of urgent email messages that they wanted me to come up and speak, and they wanted me to say the closing prayer before they began the march, which I was a little bit concerned about doing, but I did it. And not that, you know, I guess my words would mean that much, but just the response that I got when I spoke and when we all held hands and prayed about, I want to say, 1,500 people of all diverse nationalities. It was just a warm, wonderful, wonderful, eclectic mix of people, and we just felt so comforted by what we felt at that moment. And so to then go home and turn the TV on and see all of this vandalism and with the passion that it was done, I'm just empty this morning.
Why do you think this continues? And is it a situation where now anger is feeding on anger and it's not even as much about the original incident? What do you think has happened here?
Well, I think that people are hurting, and certainly a lot of our youth. As you saw it on the TV, it was a lot of our youth that were out there, and young adults. And because they're so disappointed, they feel deprived of jobs. They they're deprived of leadership, and they're just angry and hurting, and they're just lashing out. I wish there was some way that something could be set up here in Oakland that, you know, I could play a major role in terms of getting with these young people and listening to them and letting them know that we're concerned. Because I tell you, if we don't do something, it's going to continue. Every time an opportunity comes for them to be able to exhibit this anger, it's going to come out.
There is also a huge murder rate issue in Oakland, where you have some of the same young men and women out there protesting are also in the crosshairs, just based on the level of violence in the city. Do you think that there's a way to turn this around and to take people who may be violent protesters right now, but to make them realize that they really have to stand up for some kind of a nonviolent protest that respects them as people who deserve to be safe?
Because for one of the things, I don't believe that the rally organizers, that all of those people that stood out on the green yesterday in front of City Hall, I don't believe that those are the people that are doing this. I just believe that it's people that are taking opportunity to display anger. And so we have to certainly be able to divide those groups. And we have to get to that group that's so angry and, you know, that's lashing out. And I certainly believe that that's a different group from the people that held hands and prayed with me yesterday.
Well, Reverend, thank you.
Thank you very much.
That was Reverend Eltina McCree, one of the many business owners affected by the protest in Oakland. And the shooting of Oscar Grant has also raised questions about police methods of restraint and force. Rocky Warren is a police use of force expert. He served 31 years as a patrol sergeant in California. Thanks for coming on News and Notes.
Good to talk with you.
So let's go back to this original case. You have a group of young men on a train. You have them being apprehended or you know, pulled aside by officers. Based on what you've seen from the cell phone video, did they do the right thing in how they, the officers, this is, in how they tried to restrain the crowd just before the shooting?
We really don't know what brought this situation on, why the officers were even contacting the individuals in the first place. One of the things that you'll notice from the video is that there were many, many officers who were looking out, and some of the soundtracks, even though the video and soundtracks are fairly poor, you'll hear shouting from the crowd, which the officers felt enough of a wariness that they're looking out into the crowd. Most of the officers aren't even looking towards the area where the individuals are trying to be controlled. So we don't know what brought this on or started it for one point. Not to make any judgments one way or the other at this point. That's well premature.
So when you think about your experience in use of force, there's been huge critiques of police departments across America for what is considered appropriate force, you know, whether it results in a shooting or simply a verbal altercation. Very often community members will say, well, why couldn't the police have done X? Where do police officers draw the line in response? How do you make a decision if for example, there is an altercation on a train? How do police departments teach what an appropriate response is?
Well, the police use of force is pretty well set down by one lead case, which is Graham versus Connor. And the standard is whether it's reasonable. And you have to understand that includes everything that happens prior to, everything the officer knows, they're told on a radio, what the officer sees, hears, even what they smell. If they smell alcohol or observe something about the individual that indicates drug use, it heightens the level of awareness that the officer has to use. And it's really not a one-size-fits-all solution. Every situation is different.
But let's throw something else into the mix that happened here, which is a taser. The officer in question, the officer who fired the fatal shot, there's some indication he may have thought that he was pulling out a taser. Other people don't buy that theory. Regardless, what about the use of tasers? What kind of standards do officers face when they have a taser and have to decide when to use it?
Well, one of the things, I am a taser instructor, I have had a taser used on me, and I understand fully what the person having it used on them feels. As far as the use of a taser, I don't think that even is settled yet. The video is poor enough quality, and I don't think that's all the video that's available. This will be analyzed, and further video may come forward out of this. But you have to understand there's also a training response. The training response is the officer has made so many draws from a firearm, and under stress, that training response may control. They may think they're going for the taser and actually be drawing a firearm. That has happened in other jurisdictions. I'm not saying it's present in this case.
And this has to be quite brief, but what do you think is an officer's best defense against losing his or her head in a tense situation?
Proactive training and force-on-force training, where officers are put into a situation with role players who are willing to absorb impact and take the cost of the training situation so that an officer expands their comfort zone and has more options to deal with those who may be resistive.
All right. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That was Rocky Warren. He's a police use of force expert and a retired patrol sergeant for Placer County in the California Sheriff's Department. Do the crime, do the time. That's the old line, right? But convicted perpetrators are still afforded basic human rights while serving out their debt to society. The Southern Center for Human Rights recently filed suit on behalf of a group of prisoners in Decatur, Alabama. The presiding judge describes the county jail as, quote, a slave ship. There, the sheriff is accused of starving his prisoners so he could pocket the profits off a lean kitchen budget. Joining us is Lisa Kung, the executive director of the Southern Center for Human Rights. Hi, Lisa.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. So this case has just stunned people across the world. I couldn't believe it myself when I read about it. But I understand that there's a Depression-era law on the books that made this kind of profiteering legal. Tell us about the law and the details of the case.
Sure, that's right. Alabama has this arrangement where the state pays $1.75 a day to the sheriffs, directly to the sheriffs, for every person they have in his or her jail. Now, you know, you and I know it's hard enough to come up with three meals a day for $1.75. And what makes Alabama special is that it allows these sheriffs to take any of the money that they don't spend on food and put it straight into their own pocket. So last week at the hearing in federal court about this, the sheriff was forced to tell the truth on the stand. And at the end of the day, the federal judge found the sheriff in contempt, turned to the United States Marshals, and told the marshals to take the sheriff into custody.
Now, taking the sheriff into custody is just, you know, something that probably the prisoners who were sitting around hungry feel is long overdue. But the sheriff issued a statement last week denying the allegations, and it reads, quote, "The Morgan County Jail served over 328,000 meals in 2008 and only received 15 complaints on the issue of food. That is a very low number, especially coming from a jail. I have never or would not ever have tolerated an inmate being fed inadequate portions or meals for any reason." So that's his statement. What do you expect to happen moving forward with him and with this case? Do you expect him to hold on to his job? Do you expect the law to be changed?
Well, the law, immediately after this happened, the sheriffs from around the state got together and said, look, we probably should have a go at changing this law. It would be embarrassing for all of us to be exposed for the kind of money we're taking into our pockets. The sheriff in Morgan County actually had a pretty good defense. It was his best defense. I wouldn't call it a good defense. His best defense was everybody does it. I mean, the food is terrible everywhere. But what really sunk him was when it was exposed, he had to admit that he had gotten this 18-wheeler truck full of corn dogs from a friend of his. Essentially, he and another sheriff split a 18-wheeler truckload full of corn dogs for $1,000, $500 a piece, and these are corn dogs that couldn't be sold anywhere else. And he had to tell the story of how he got these corn dogs essentially for free and then was able to feed the people in his jail breakfast, lunch, and dinner for 2 months on these corn dogs, and was somewhat proud of himself for having done this. And that's really what sunk him was. It was revealed, you know, this money went straight into his pocket, and last year he pocketed well over $95,000 while the people in his jail went hungry. And when this comes out, you know, the sheriffs around the state, this is happening all over the state, but they've been able to sort of operate in secret. They've refused to reveal how much money is being put in their own pocket. And so I think they're scrambling right now to try to save face, to try to do something to change the law. And we'll see what happens next year.
What are the ripple effects of this and the ramifications for other districts? Are there any other places, first of all, that have this law?
You know, we had thought that Alabama was unique in this way, but right after the story broke, we got a call from a sheriff in Indiana who said, look, this happens here all the time as well. I've chosen not to participate here. I feed my people a little bit better. And he was very adamant but that, you know, that this happens in other places, but that really should be changed because it's an embarrassment. It's an embarrassment to the sheriffs to be operating in this kind of system.
What do you think the value is to the conversation over prisoners' rights of having a case like this? I mean, on the one hand, it seems really outrageous, but on the other hand, it is one of these sunshine cases where there is some light that's been shown on a practice that most people never even knew about. So what kind of ripple effects do you expect it to have as people look in general on the broader level of what people convicted of crimes deserve? Because that's one of the things we're looking at in our series, is that just because you've been convicted of a crime doesn't mean that all of your rights are stripped away. So what remains and what should remain? Do you think this will help people dig into that issue a little bit more?
Sure. I think you've just a couple of points there. One is that what was happening here was in a jail. And jails are places where folks are going before they've been tried or convicted of anything. So these are overwhelmingly, you know, poor folks that can't make bond who are awaiting trial. But I think, you know, the thrust of your question is exactly right. What do we learn from this kind of case? We didn't learn anything by learning that prisoners are being fed crummy food. I think the lesson here is, you know, prisons and jails are these secretive places. They're walled off from public scrutiny. And the moment you sort of lift that secrecy and you have people actually describe what's going on, admit what's going on, it's shocking and it's embarrassing and it's not the sort of thing that we can tolerate in a free society. The food is one issue. The amount of violence, the kinds of disrespect, the poor medical care, these are the sort of larger issues that the moment you sort of you shine a light on those issues, it becomes very apparent that prisons and jails are places that need far, far more public scrutiny than they're afforded right now.
In terms of the idea of rehabilitating people or preparing them to go back into society, obviously jails are more transitional. But in terms of prisons, just your personal take on it, do you think that we're making any progress in really trying to deal with the issue of reentry into society?
Well, the prison system is one where it's befuddling why we don't demand more accountability. I mean, we would not tolerate any other public institution that makes things worse. Hospitals that make people sicker than they are. I mean, we wouldn't tolerate that sort of thing. If you look at the results of prison, you know, prisons have not made us any safer. It's this big question of whether prisons rehabilitate people or not has been settled for a couple hundred years. They certainly don't. The question of whether prisons or jails do anything for the crime rate has been settled. The answer is no. There's essentially no correlation between the number of people in prisons and jails and the crime rate. It brings the basic question up: what is the point of having prisons?
All right, Lisa, thank you.
Thank you.
That was Lisa Kung, the executive director of the Southern Center for Human Rights, and she joined us from Doppler Studios in Atlanta, Georgia. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. It's time now for a look at the week in sports with our own Tony Cox. Hey, Tony.
Hey, Farai. You know, playoffs, drafts, retirements, leaves of absence. Is this sports? I guess it is. Those are some of the subjects we're going to tackle in this week's Bloggers Roundtable. And to join me to do all of that, we have Kevin Figures. He writes the blog for sports station AM570Radio.com here in L.A. And Karen Phillips blogs at TheMavenReport.com down in Atlanta. Gentlemen, nice to have you back.
Good to be here, Tony. What's going on, Tony?
Let's talk about this first. Today, the deadline for all college football players wanting to toss their names into the NFL draft. And sure enough, aspiring pros have been coming out of the woodwork all week long, including today. Of course, in football, a good quarterback is always the prize of the draft. And this year, there were interesting prospects at the QB position, to say the least. Tim Tebow, Florida. Matthew Stafford, Georgia. Sam Bradford, Oklahoma. Mark Sanchez, USC. Nate Davis, Ball State. And Colt McCoy, Texas. Kevin, it looks like only Sanchez and Davis are going to jump to the pros.
That's the way it's looking right now. Bradford's already said he's coming back. At the Florida rally, Tim Tebow said he was going to come back, which I think is the best option for him. I don't think he's going to be a first-round quarterback. He might not even be a first-day player drafted. So I think that's the best decision for him. Matt Stafford, I don't think he's decided yet whether he wants to go or whether he wants to stay. I think as far as being a pure pro prospect, he's probably the best one coming out of all the quarterbacks available to enter into.
Now, Karen, you know, how good a draft class do you think this is, number one? And number two, do you think that the decisions that we've seen so far by the players on whether they will stay or go, have those been the right ones, the right decisions?
As a class as a whole, I'm not sure yet. I know I just found out that Stafford, him and Moreno are going from UGA. So the quarterbacks, it's kind of up in the air. Some of the best guys are staying, like Bradford and Tebow. But as a whole, I'm not too sure yet. The underclassmen like Crabtree and Macklin coming out, those guys are pretty good. I think they're ready for the pros right now. But as a whole, I wouldn't be ready to give the class a specific grade right now. But I think most of the guys have made good decisions in terms of like Bradford and especially Tebow coming back for one more year.
Who do you think should be number one, Kevin? Who do you think will be number one?
The number one overall pick or the number one quarterback?
Number one overall and then the number one quarterback.
Number one overall pick? I'm not sure. All the prognosticators have come out. The offensive tackle from Alabama, whose name is slipping me right now, who got suspended for the Sugar Bowl, actually. I forget his name. He's actually a good prospect. A lot of people have him ranked high as one of the top players taken. Stafford is actually up there as one of the best quarterback prospects, one of the best overall prospects coming out of the draft. So I'm probably going to think it's going to be either one of those two, either the Alabama offensive tackle or Matthew Stafford if he comes out.
What about quarterback? You think he would be the number one?
I think he would be the top quarterback taken
over Sanchez.
I think over Sanchez. I think he has, as far as pure intangibles, and like a lot of these general managers like to draft off of intangibles and what they can do for you in the future. I think Stafford has a bigger upside than Sanchez does in the pros.
All right, we'll find out. One other thing before we move on, Karen, is this. USC's defense could produce two top 10 picks and four top 20 picks, but a lot has been made of the decision by Taylor Mays, their top defensive player, All-American safety, to stay in school another year. I guess that's good news for Pete Carroll and USC, wouldn't you think?
Oh, I know Pete Carroll has to be ecstatic. I expected Taylor Mays to go. I expected him to be a first-round pick, first-day pick. With him coming back, it just gives his defense a little more help because I know a lot of those guys are going. But it's USC. Pete Carroll stays loaded out there on the West Coast, so he should be ranked either in the top three when polls come out.
One more thing, Kevin, about the college football draft is this. When you look back on some recent drafts, including Matt Leinart, Vince Young, both who were superstars in college, Not so much in the NFL so far for either one of them, actually. What does that say about the quality of quarterbacks coming out of college? And, you know, who's overrated, do you think?
Oh, there's plenty of overrated. Another example you can maybe use is Jamarcus Russell, who's still young and he's still starting with the Oakland Raiders.
Yep.
That a lot of these general managers, as I said, draft off of intangibles and not what a player can actually do. Matt Leiner was in a situation at USC where he played with so much talent. It was hard for any quarterback who was halfway decent to not succeed. Vince Young played in a gimmick system at Texas where he was able to do whatever he wanted to, and he found out in the pros that he's not able to do that. So it just comes down to the NFL is a different type of game than college football. You're not going to have a loaded team around you all the time where you're gonna have plays to dump off to Reggie Bush from 5 yards in the flat and he can make plays downfield. Reggie Bush is not a quarterback, but he's also a player that came out and has also struggled in the NFL.
True.
So a great college player does not always translate to a great NFL player, and a lot of these general managers don't know that for some reason.
Well, they find out pretty quickly.
Yes,
don't they
do. They
absolutely
do.
All right, guys, let's move on to one more thing. I want to go back to the BCS championship game and the controversy. Florida, Karen, number one in BCS, but a lot of folks are claiming that they don't deserve the outright title, even President-elect Obama. Here is the new president.
Congratulations to Florida. I have to point out, if I'm Utah, if I'm USC, or if I'm Texas, I may still have some quibbles, and you've heard my pitch. That's why we need a playoff.
Yeah, but it ain't gonna happen, is it, Karen? Not with ESPN involved.
It's not gonna happen. Much as I love the president-elect, I have to disagree with him. The only people I think who have an argument are Texas, because they did beat Oklahoma, and I do believe that should have been a national title game. Texas, Florida. But Utah does have a strong case. They are the only 13-0 team in the country. I had a feeling going into the Alabama game they were going to win. I just wish some kind of way it could have been Utah, Texas, or Florida to figure that thing out at the end of the season.
Well, good thing you're on the east side of the Mississippi River, because on this side of the Mississippi River, people are saying USC should have been involved.
Not a chance. Oregon State proved it to everybody. The two Rogers brothers, they exposed USC that Thursday night on ESPN. I sat there and watched the game. USC, I'm sorry, they did not deserve it.
We just don't have it every year. We don't have enough time to have this argument. I'm going to have you on in a couple of weeks. Let's move on to the NFL. Perhaps the biggest football news of the week, Kevin, though not a total surprise, has to do with the Indianapolis Colts. Coach Tony Dungy stepping down, the only black coach to ever win a Super Bowl. So I'm not clear, what do you think his legacy is? I mean, a lot has been made about him, about the fine person he is, the fine coach that he's been. His record has been good at Indianapolis, but they haven't won that. They only won the big one one time.
Very true. They've only won the big one time. They've been the favorites more often than not. I think you have to look at Tony Dungy's coaching career as a whole and where he came from, as taking the Vikings defense and doing a great job with them, going to a dead Tampa Bay franchise that was actually a sieve. Nobody cared. They were one of the worst franchises in sports. Took them and turned them into a perennial playoff power, got them to the NFC title game, and they were probably a bad call away from going to the Super Bowl that year with the whole, you know, Ben Emanuel catch and all of that. So I think Tony Dungy goes down as one of the greatest coaches of all time. The other thing is, the only coach in NFL history to have to go to the playoffs 10 consecutive seasons. That has to say something, you know. And he's always been competitive. He's never, you know, I think he's bowed out once in the playoffs with Indianapolis. He got embarrassed by the Jets 1 year. But his teams are always competitive. His teams always played hard for him. No player has ever complained about him. I think he's one of the greatest coaches of all time.
You know,
I think he's a Hall of Famer.
A lot has been made, Kyron, about the fact that there aren't enough black head football coaches in college. But although there are more now in the NFL, Dungy being one of them, what's unusual, I think, is that Dungy's being replaced by another African-American. You don't usually have one black head coach replaced by another, do you?
Not necessarily. This one was a rare case with Jim Caldwell coming in. It's good to see another black face with a head coaching position on the sidelines in the NFL. But like, the problem still remains, like you said, Tony, in college football, in the NFL, we don't have enough. We need more. That's why the Rooney Rule is in effect. We need more black head coaches on these sidelines.
Now, in the NFL playoffs coming up this weekend, Eagles versus Cardinals and the Steelers versus the Ravens. Who do you like, Kevin?
I like the Eagles. I like to be the Eagles and the Steelers. I think the Ravens' defense is playing well. Their offense is okay. But when it comes down to it, it comes down to whose offense can make more plays. I think the Steelers' offense has a chance to make more plays against the Ravens' defense than the other way around. And the Eagles embarrassed the Cardinals earlier this year on Thanksgiving Day. I think it's going to be more of the same this week.
Billy, you think that same way, Kyron?
No, I think the Steelers and the Cardinals. But first of all, I have to apologize to Donovan McNabb, because last time I was on here, I said his career was over in Philly. But he proved me wrong.
He proved you wrong.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
He's doing this thing out in Philadelphia. But I'm going with the Cardinals. They've been proving everybody wrong so far. Bolden's coming back. Breston and Fitzgerald are having monster years. And I think Kurt Warner still has a little bit left in the tank. And they have the running game going with Edgerrin James.
I like the Cardinals, too. Kurt Warner seems to be on a mission this year. Let's switch to Major League Baseball, guys. The Hall of Fame announcing its latest inductees, among them Ricky Henderson, Jim Rice. Now, Kevin, Ricky Henderson was a first ballot selection, although 28 writers did not vote for him. This guy's an all-time steals leader in baseball, played effectively into his 40s. Controversial, sure, but come on. How could he not be a unanimous first ballot choice?
The greatest leadoff hitter of all time, most people will tell you. How you can be the greatest anything of all time and not be a unanimous, or at least close to unanimous? How can you be one of the 28? I don't know how you sleep at night being one of the 28 who doesn't vote him to be in the Hall of Fame. How could you not? A lot of these guys are just stubborn to where they just don't want anybody to be a first ballot. I don't know why. I don't know why it's such a big deal to them, but they don't want anybody to be unanimous, and I don't see what the big issue is. Ricky Henderson is one of the greatest baseball players of all time. You can say he's kooky or he's you know, whatever, but he was a great baseball player.
Absolutely.
That's all that should matter.
Absolutely. And now, on the other hand, Karen, Jim Rice got in finally on his 15th and last try. My question is, why are the sports writers who vote for the Hall of Fame allowed to do so anonymously? Do you think that's right?
No, I think they should put their first and last names and government names and all that on the ballot list. I think these players should know who's voting and who shouldn't, because with Jim Rice's, in his case, he should have been in the Hall of Fame. We should know these 28 voters who didn't vote Ricky Henderson in, because that's a shame. He's Ricky Henderson. It's Ricky being Ricky. This guy's numbers are no one's better than his. First, you look at his numbers, he's first in almost everything he's ever done.
That's true.
And but he was, 44, 45 out there still stealing bases?
Still stealing bases, absolutely.
I mean, this guy, it shouldn't even been a vote for Ricky Henderson.
Absolutely.
They should have just gave him the jersey and sent him to Cooperstown. No application needed.
Here's a young guy, we're going to move to college basketball, who is going to be in the, at least at the college ranks at the University of Kentucky, in their Hall of Fame. And who knows what's going to be in his career later on. Karan, I'm talking about Jody Meeks. I don't know if you guys got to see him in the game, Kentucky against Tennessee. He went off for 54 points. It was an amazing college performance, wasn't it?
I didn't actually see the game. I saw the highlights, though. 14-14 from the free throw line, 10-15 from the three-point line, and he scored 54, only shooting 22 times. People may not think that's a lot after Kobe scored 81 for the Lakers a couple of years back, but you have to remember, in college, it's a 35-second shot clock, so that's less possessions. There's less times for your team to have the ball and less opportunities for you to score. So 54 in a college game where you can play a true zone defense against a man, that's a lot. That is a great number.
Absolutely. He broke Dan Issel's scoring record, which was set in 1970. I guess this puts him in the conversation with player of the year possibilities, Kevin, right?
He's been good all year long. You know, he has good numbers. I think he's one of the top scorers in the SEC. Player of the year honors, I'm not sure. I don't think he's going to pass up Blake Griffin from Oklahoma or players like that with this one performance. It definitely put his name on the map for people who didn't know who Jody Meeks was. Anybody that watched Kentucky has known the last couple of years how good of a player that he actually is. But it was an amazing performance from what he did. You rarely ever see that in college basketball, where the court is so compact and the defense is so, is like you said, the zone defense is so good. You rarely ever see that kind of scoring performance in college basketball.
All right, let's end the sports bloggers on this topic. We've got about 30 seconds or so. Charles Barkley, he said he's not a role model now that he's been arrested again, talking about alcohol and his, shall we say, sexual escapades. I guess he's right. He ain't a role model, is he, Kyron?
He said he wasn't a role model. He isn't one, but we need Charles back on the air. He made the right decision, but I'll be happy to see him back on TNT in a couple of weeks.
People are missing him. The show's not the same without him, is it, Kevin?
No, not even. No, Charles makes that show. I like Kenny and those guys, but Charles is the face of that show.
He just needs to behave himself.
Mm-hmm.
All right, gentlemen, I appreciate you coming on. Kyron Phillips blogs at themavenreport.com, joining us from Georgia Public Broadcasting in Atlanta. And Kevin Figures writes the blog for sports station AM 570 Radio. He joined us right here in our studios at NPR West.
I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. It's time now for a look at the week in sports with our own Tony Cox. Hey, Tony.
Hey, Farai. You know, playoffs, drafts, retirements, leaves of absence. Is this sports? I guess it is. Those are some of the subjects we're going to tackle in this week's Bloggers Roundtable. And to join me to do all of that, we have Kevin Figures. He writes the blog for sports station AM570Radio.com here in L.A. And Karen Phillips blogs at TheMavenReport.com down in Atlanta. Gentlemen, nice to have you back.
Good to be here, Tony.
What's going on, Tony?
Let's talk about this first. Today, the deadline for all college football players wanting to toss their names into the NFL draft. And sure enough, aspiring pros have been coming out of the woodwork all week long, including today. Of course, in football, a good quarterback is always the prize of the draft. And this year, there were interesting prospects at the QB position, to say the least. Tim Tebow, Florida. Matthew Stafford, Georgia. Sam Bradford, Oklahoma. Mark Sanchez, USC. Nate Davis, Ball State. And Colt McCoy, Texas. Kevin, it looks like only Sanchez and Davis are going to jump to the pros.
That's the way it's looking right now. Bradford's already said he's coming back. At the Florida rally, Tim Tebow said he was going to come back, which I think is the best option for him. I don't think he's going to be a first-round quarterback. He might not even be a first-day player drafted. So I think that's the best decision for him. Matt Stafford, I don't think he's decided yet whether he wants to go or whether he wants to stay. I think as far as being a pure pro prospect, he's probably the best one coming out of all the quarterbacks available to enter into.
Now, Karen, you know, how good a draft class do you think this is, number one? And number two, do you think that the decisions that we've seen so far by the players on whether they will stay or go, have those been the right ones, the right decisions?
As a class as a whole, I'm not sure yet. I know I just found out that Stafford, him and Moreno are going from UGA. So the quarterbacks, it's kind of up in the air. Some of the best guys are staying, like Bradford and Tebow. But as a whole, I'm not too sure yet. The underclassmen like Crabtree and Macklin coming out, those guys are pretty good. I think they're ready for the pros right now. But as a whole, I wouldn't be ready to give the class a specific grader right now. But I think most of the guys have made good decisions in terms of like Bradford and especially Tebow coming back for one more year.
Who do you think should be number one, Kevin? Who do you think will be number one?
The number one overall pick or the number one quarterback?
Number one overall and then the number one quarterback.
Number one overall pick? I'm not sure. All the prognosticators have come out. The offensive tackle from Alabama, whose name is slipping me right now, who got suspended for the national Sugar Bowl, actually. I forget his name. He's actually a good prospect. A lot of people have him ranked high as one of the top players taken. Stafford is actually up there as one of the best quarterback prospects, one of the best overall prospects coming out of the draft. So I'm probably gonna think it's gonna be either one of those two, either the Alabama offensive tackle or Matthew Stafford if he comes out.
What about quarterback? You think he would be the number one?
I think he would be the top quarterback taken
over Sanchez.
I think over Sanchez. I think he has, as far as pure intangibles, and like a lot of these general managers like to draft off of intangibles and you know, what they can do for you in the future. I think Stafford has a bigger upside than Sanchez does in the pros.
All right, we'll find out. One other thing before we move on, Karen, is this. USC's defense could produce two top 10 picks and four top 20 picks, but a lot has been made of the decision by Taylor Mays, their top defensive player, All-American safety, to stay in school another year. I guess that's good news for Pete Carroll and USC, wouldn't you think?
Oh, I know Pete Carroll has to be ecstatic. I expected Taylor Mays to go. I expected him to be a first-round pick, first-day pick. With him coming back, it just gives his defense a little more help because I know a lot of those guys are going. But it's USC. Pete Carroll stays loaded out there on the West Coast, so he should be ranked either in the top three when polls come out.
One more thing, Kevin, about the college football draft is this. When you look back on some recent drafts, including Matt Leinart, Vince Young, both who were superstars in college, not so much in the NFL so far for either one of them, actually. What does that say about the quality of quarterbacks coming out of college? And, you know, who's overrated, do you think?
Oh, there's plenty of overrated. Another example you can maybe use is Jamarcus Russell, who's still young and he's still starting with the Oakland Raiders.
Yep.
That a lot of these general managers, as I said, draft off of intangibles and not what a player can actually do. Matt Leinart was in a situation at USC where he played with so much talent, it was hard for any quarterback who was halfway decent to not succeed. Vince Young played in a gimmick system at Texas where he was able to do whatever he wanted to, and he found out in the pros that he's not able to do that. So it just comes down to the NFL is a different type of game than college football. You're not going to have a loaded team around you all the time where you're gonna have plays to dump off to Reggie Bush from 5 yards in the flat and he can make plays downfield. Reggie Bush is not a quarterback, but he's also a player that came out and has also struggled in the NFL.
True.
So a great college player does not always translate to great NFL player. And a lot of these general managers obviously don't know that for some reason.
Well, they find out pretty quickly,
yes,
don't
they? Yes, they do.
Absolutely. All right, guys, let's move on to one more thing. I want to go back to the BCS championship game and the controversy. Florida, Karen, number one in BCS, but a lot of folks are claiming that they don't deserve the outright title, even President-elect Obama. Here is the new president.
Congratulations to Florida. I have to point out, if I'm Utah, if I'm USC, or if I'm Texas, I may still have some quibbles. You've heard my pitch. That's why we need a playoff.
Yeah, but it ain't going to happen, is it, Karen? Not with ESPN involved.
It's not going to happen. Much as I love the president-elect, I have to disagree with him. The only people I think who have an argument are Texas, because they did beat Oklahoma, and I do believe that should have been a national title game, Texas-Florida. But Utah does have a strong case. They are the only 13-0 team in the country. I had a feeling going into the Alabama game they were going to win. I just wish some kind of way it could have been Utah, Texas, or Florida to figure that thing out at the end of the season.
Well, good thing you're on the east side of the Mississippi River, because on this side of the Mississippi River, people are saying USC should have been involved.
Not a chance. Oregon State proved it to everybody. The two Rogers brothers, they exposed USC that Thursday night on ESPN. I sat there and watched the game. USC, I'm sorry, they did not deserve it.
They just do it every year. We don't have enough time to have this argument. I'm going to have you on in a couple of weeks. Let's move on to the NFL. Perhaps the biggest football news of the week, Kevin, though not a total surprise, has to do with the Indianapolis Colts. Coach Tony Dungy stepping down, the only black coach to ever win a Super Bowl. So I'm not clear, what do you think his legacy is? I mean, a lot has been made about him, about the fine person he is, the fine coach that he's been. His record has been good at Indianapolis, but they haven't won that. They only won the big one one time.
Very true. They've only won the big one time. They've been the favorites more often than not. I think you have to look at Tony Dungy's coaching career as a whole and where he came from, as taking the Vikings defense, doing a great job with them, going to a dead Tampa Bay franchise that was actually a sieve. Nobody cared. They were one of the worst franchises in sports. Took them and turned them into a perennial playoff power, got them to the NFC title game, and they were probably a bad call away from going to the Super Bowl that year with the whole, you know, Ben Emanuel catch and all of that. So I think Tony Dungy goes down as one of the greatest coaches of all time. I think he's the only coach in NFL history to have to go to the playoffs 10 consecutive seasons. That has to say something, you know. And he's always been competitive. He's never, you know, I think he's bowed out once in the playoffs with Indianapolis. He got embarrassed by the Jets one year. But his teams are always competitive. His teams always played hard for him. No player has ever complained about him. I think he's one of the greatest coaches of all time. I think he's a Hall of Famer.
A lot has been made, Kyron, about the fact that there aren't enough black head football coaches in college. But although there are more now in the NFL, Dungy being one of them, what's unusual, I think, is that Dungy's being replaced by another African-American. You don't usually have one black head coach replaced by another, do you?
Not necessarily. This one was a rare case with Jim Caldwell coming in. It's good to see another black face with a head coaching position on the sidelines in the NFL. But like the problem still remains, like you said, Tony, in college football, in the NFL, we don't have enough. We need more. That's why the Rooney Rule is in effect. We need more black head coaches on these sidelines.
Now, in the NFL playoffs coming up this weekend, Eagles versus Cardinals and the Steelers versus the Ravens. Who do you like, Kevin?
I like the Eagles. I like to be the Eagles and the Steelers. I think the Ravens' defense is playing well. Their offense is okay. But when it comes down to it, it comes down to whose offense can make more plays. I think the Steelers' offense has a chance to make more plays against the Ravens' defense than the other way around. And the Eagles embarrassed the Cardinals earlier this year on Thanksgiving Day. I think it's going to be more of the same this week.
Billy, you think that same way, Kyron?
No, I think the Steelers and the Cardinals. But first of all, I have to apologize to Donovan McNabb, because last time I was on here, I said his career was over in Philly. But he proved me wrong.
He proved you wrong.
Yeah,
absolutely.
He's doing this thing out in Philadelphia. But I think I'm going with the Cardinals. They've been proving everybody wrong so far. Bolden's coming back. Breston and Fitzgerald having monster years. And I think Kurt Warner still has a little bit left in the tank. And they have the running game going with Edgerrin James.
I like the Cardinals, too. Kurt Warner seems to be on a mission this year. Let's switch to Major League Baseball, guys. The Hall of Fame announcing its latest inductees, among them Ricky Henderson, Jim Rice. Now, Kevin, Ricky Henderson was a first ballot selection, although 28 writers did not vote for him. This guy's an all-time steals leader in baseball, played effectively into his 40s. Controversial, sure, but come on. How could he not be a unanimous first ballot choice?
The greatest leadoff hitter of all time, most people will tell you. How you can be the greatest anything of all time and not be a unanimous, or at least close to unanimous? How can you be one of the 28? I don't know how you sleep at night being one of the 28 who doesn't vote him to be in the Hall of Fame. How could you not? A lot of these guys are just stubborn to where they just don't want anybody to be a first ballot. I don't know why. I don't know why it's such a big deal to them, but they don't want anybody to be unanimous, and I don't see what the big issue is. Ricky Henderson is one of the greatest baseball players of all time. You can say he's kooky or he's you know, whatever, but he was a great baseball player.
Absolutely.
That's all that should matter.
Absolutely. And now, on the other hand, Karen, Jim Rice got in finally on his 15th and last try. My question is, why are the sports writers who vote for the Hall of Fame allowed to do so anonymously? Do you think that's right?
No, I think they should put their first and last names and government names and all that on the ballot list. I think these players should know who's voting and who shouldn't, because with Jim Rice's, in his case, he should have been in the Hall of Fame. We should know these 28 voters who didn't vote Ricky Henderson in, because that's a shame. He's Ricky Henderson. It's Ricky being Ricky. This guy's numbers are no one's better than his. First, you look at his numbers, he's first in almost everything he's ever done.
That's true.
And but he was, 44, 45 out there still stealing bases?
Still stealing bases, absolutely.
I mean, this guy, it shouldn't even been a vote for Ricky Henderson.
Absolutely.
They should have just gave him the jersey and sent him to Cooperstown. No application needed.
Here's a young guy, we're going to move to college basketball, who is going to be in the, at least at the college ranks at the University of Kentucky, in their Hall of Fame, and who knows what's going to be in his career later on. Karan, I'm talking about Jody Meeks. I don't know if you guys got to see him in the game Kentucky against Tennessee. He went off for 54 points. It was an amazing college performance, wasn't it?
I didn't actually see the game. I saw the highlights, though. 14-14 from the free throw line, 10-15 from the three-point line, and he scored 54, only shooting 22 times. People may not think that's a lot after Kobe scored 81 for the Lakers a couple of years back, but you have to remember, in college, it's a 35-second shot clock, so that's less possessions. There's less times for your team to have the ball and less opportunities for you to score. So 54 in a college game where you can play a true zone defense against a man, that's a lot. That is a great number.
Absolutely. He broke Dan Issel's scoring record, which was set in 1970. I guess this puts him in the conversation with player of the year possibilities, Kevin, right?
He's been good all year long. You know, he has good numbers. I think he's one of the top scorers in the SEC. Player of the year honors, I'm not sure. I don't think he's going to pass up Blake Griffin from Oklahoma or players like that with this one performance. It definitely put his name on the map for people who didn't know who Jody Meeks was. Anybody that watched Kentucky has known the last couple of years how good of a player that he actually is. But it was an amazing performance from what he did. You rarely ever see that in college basketball, where the court is so compact and the defense is so, is like you said, the zone defense is so good. You rarely ever see that kind of scoring performance in college basketball.
All right, let's end this Sports Bloggers on this topic. We've got about 30 seconds or so. Charles Barkley, he said he's not a role model now that he's been arrested again, talking about alcohol and his, shall we say, sexual escapades. I guess he's right. He ain't a role model, is he, Kyron?
He said he wasn't a role model. He isn't one, but we need Charles back on the air. He made the right decision, but I'll be happy to see him back on TNT in a couple of weeks.
People aren't missing him. The show's not the same without him, is it, Kevin?
No, not even. Charles makes that show. I like Kenny and those guys, but Charles is the face of that show.
He just needs to behave himself.
Mm-hmm.
All right, gentlemen, I appreciate you coming on. Kyron Phillips blogs at themavenreport.com, joining us from Georgia Public Broadcasting in Atlanta. And Kevin Figures writes the blog for sports station AM 570 Radio. He joined us right here in our studios at NPR West.
From NPR News, I'm Farai Chidea. For Thursday, January 15th, this is News and Notes. Oakland stays tense as a transit police officer is charged with the New Year's Day murder of an unarmed black man. We'll have the latest on the case and how people in the community are reacting. Plus, what makes someone think they can pull a gun on a bank teller and get away with it? We'll continue our crime series with a look at perpetrators, why they do it, and what kind of penalties they face. And the NFL draft deadline for college football players is today. Who's planning on playing hooky for the big paycheck? And the only black coach to win a Super Bowl takes his final bow. We'll be right back. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. Another Hamas leader has been killed in an Israeli airstrike. Hamas television reports Gaza's interior minister, Saeed Sayyam, died today. He was in charge of thousands of security forces across the Hamas-controlled territory. Fighting has intensified in Gaza as Israeli troops push deeper into the main city. United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon, who is in the region, called the Israeli shelling of a UN compound today an outrage. NPR's Anne Garrels has details.
The main UN warehouse with food supplies was hit, and some 700 civilians seeking refuge there had to flee yet again. There were conflicting comments from the Israeli government. The defense minister apologized. The Israeli government spokesman said it was far from clear Israel had indeed hit the compound. Then Prime Minister Ehud Olmert weighed in, saying Israel hit the UN compound, but only because the Israeli military had come under fire from Hamas militants inside. An account dismissed by UN official who was inside at the time as nonsense. Shells also struck two hospitals and a building housing media outlets. Anne Garrels, NPR News, Jerusalem.
The Senate Foreign Relations Committee has voted overwhelmingly for Hillary Rodham Clinton to become the next Secretary of State. A full Senate vote will take place after President-elect Barack Obama is sworn in next Tuesday. Hours after getting Senate approval, Clinton delivered a farewell speech to her Senate colleagues. Vice President-elect Joe Biden did the same.
I leave here today to begin my service to our nation's first African-American president.
Biden received a standing ovation. He and President-elect Obama will be sworn in next Tuesday. California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger delivers his State of the State address this hour. Steve Julian of member station KPCC says the governor, now in his second term, faces a financial calamity.
California is $42 billion in the red. That figure looks ahead about 18 months and illuminates one of Schwarzenegger's most difficult challenges, brokering a compromise with state lawmakers. Democrats control California's legislature, but any budget proposal that includes tax increases, such as the ones Democrats want, requires a two-thirds vote. Republicans oppose higher taxes, even though the governor has included them in his most recent proposal. California is poised to run out of cash next month. Already, state offices are cutting back hours. The wrangling between Democrats and Republicans in the legislature has spread beyond the budget and into water, education, and health care issues. For NPR News, I'm Steve Julian in Los Angeles.
U.S. stocks continue to lose ground. At last check, the Dow was down 165 points at 8,035. NASDAQ was down about 23 at 1467. This is NPR News. Today, Iran's president said the incoming Obama administration must change the U.S. approach to his country. Tensions between the two countries have been high over Iran's nuclear program, which Tehran denies is aimed at producing weapons. Roxana Saberi has this from Tehran.
Iran's president has said the U.S. government should make at least two changes in its behavior. Mahmoud Ahmadinejad said the first should be to stop interfering in the affairs of other countries, and the second to change Washington's approach to Iran. He said it's been many years that the U.S. has oppressed the Iranian nation, and he added that if America's previous behavior continues with only minor changes, what he called the world's affairs will continue as before. Ahmadinejad was speaking at a news conference in Tehran. President-elect Barack Obama has said he views Iran as a genuine threat, but he still favors initiating a dialogue. For NPR News, I'm Roxana Saberi in Tehran.
U.S. Attorney General designee Eric Holder was grilled today over decisions made when he was the number two official in the Justice Department. They include the controversial pardon of fugitive financier Mark Rich. Today, Holder said he should have studied the pardon more closely. Holder is pledging to come down hard on financial fraud if he is confirmed as Attorney General. In a break from previous Justice Department practice, Holder said he believed the interrogation method of waterboarding was torture. Holder also said the prison at Guantanamo Bay will close, but will take some time. Arizona Governor Janet Napolitano, selected by Mr. Obama to be the next Homeland Security Secretary, is talking to lawmakers about some of the biggest challenges the department faces, including low morale among workers. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this and other NPR stations, and from the David Bruce Smith Family Foundation, supporting humanitarian causes.
From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. A former Bay Area Rapid Transit police officer in Oakland, California, has been charged with the murder of an unarmed black man. Oscar Grant III was shot in the back as he lay face down on a train platform on New Year's Day. Alameda County District Attorney Tom Orloff made a rare decision to file a murder charge against a police officer for an on-duty incident. He explained why at a press conference yesterday.
Murder charges were filed because at this point, what I feel the evidence indicates is an unlawful killing done by an intentional act, and from the evidence we have, there's nothing that would mitigate that to something lower than a murder.
The officer in question, 27-year-old Johannes Messerly, was arrested in Nevada. His attorney, Christopher Miller, says he expects Messerly to be cleared of all charges once the night's events become clear. John Burris is the attorney for the victim's family. He recounted the family's response to the latest developments.
For the mom, she's been very saddened, of course, and she's certainly in deep mourning. And her response was, "That's very good, but it doesn't bring my son back." So there's certainly a large degree of elation in the family, and that this process at least has started.
John Burris is the attorney for the victim's family, and he is someone who is tracking this very carefully. For more, we have a look at protests in Oakland following Oscar Grant shootings, including one just last night. Some shops were damaged. Many business owners are wondering what are going to happen next. Joining me now, we've got Reverend Eltina McCree. She runs a clothing store on 17th Street, one of the areas affected by the demonstrations. Welcome to News and Notes.
Greetings.
So there were more demonstrations last night. What is the scene like this morning?
Well, it's just like it was last Wednesday, a cleanup scene. Merchants in the central part of town, city center, where the 12th Street BART station is located, were hit last night. And, of course, Wells Fargo Bank and a number of our other beloved food or places were hit last night, and you saw it, of course, on TV. You saw it as it was happening. So, you know, it's just cleanup this morning, and our spirits are down.
When you say your spirits are down, that must be an understatement. I mean, what kind of conversations are you having right now with your neighbors and with other people who are in the community trying to bring people together?
Well, I'm literally, people, of course, have come up to me. The riot last week, the vandalism last week, centered on 17th Street, which is where I'm located. And I represent the South of Broadway 17th Street merchants. And so I've been very verbal for this whole time. And the sad part of it is that they're asking me for kind of direction this morning, and I feel empty. Yesterday, the protest, the rally, Derica Blackman actually called me about 3 o'clock and sent me a couple of urgent email messages that they wanted me to come up and speak, and they wanted me to say the closing prayer before they began the march, which I was a little bit concerned about doing, but I did it. And not that, you know, I guess my words would mean that much, but just the response that I got when I spoke and when we all held hands and prayed about, I want to say, 1,500 people of all diverse nationalities. It was just a warm, wonderful, wonderful, eclectic mix of people, and we just felt so comforted by what we felt at that moment. And so to then go home and turn the TV on and see all of this vandalism and with the passion that it was done, I'm just empty this morning.
Why do you think this continues? And is it a situation where now anger is feeding on anger and it's not even as much about the original incident? What do you think has happened here?
Well, I think that people are hurting, and certainly a lot of our youth. As you saw it on the TV, it was a lot of our youth that were out there, and young adults. And because they're so disappointed, they feel deprived of jobs, they're deprived of leadership, and they're just angry and hurting, and they're just lashing out. I wish there was some way that something could be set up here in Oakland that, you know, I could play a major role in terms of getting with these young people and listening to them and letting them know that we're concerned. Because I tell you, if we don't do something, it's going to continue. Every time an opportunity comes for them to be able to exhibit this anger, it's going to come out.
There is also a huge murder rate issue in Oakland, where you have some of the same young men and women out there protesting are also in the crosshairs, just based on the level of violence in the city. Do you think that there's a way to get to turn this around and to take people who may be violent protesters right now, but to make them realize that they really have to stand up for some kind of a nonviolent protest that respects them as people who deserve to be safe?
Because for one of the things, I don't believe that the rally organizers, that all of those people that stood out on the green yesterday in front of City Hall, I don't believe that those are the people that are doing this. I just believe that it's people that are taking opportunity to display anger. And so we have to certainly be able to divide those groups. And we have to get to that group that's so angry and, you know, that's lashing out. And I certainly believe that that's a different group from the people that held hands and prayed with me yesterday.
Well, Reverend, thank you.
Thank you very much.
That was Reverend Eltina McCree, one of the many business owners affected by the protest in Oakland. And the shooting of Oscar Grant has also raised questions about police methods of restraint and force. Rocky Warren is a police use of force expert. He served 31 years as a patrol sergeant in California. Thanks for coming on News and Notes.
Good to talk with you.
So let's go back to this original case. You have a group of young men on a train. You have them being apprehended or you know, pulled aside by officers. Based on what you've seen from the cell phone video, did they do the right thing in how they, the officers, this is, in how they tried to restrain the crowd just before the shooting?
We really don't know what brought this situation on, why the officers were even contacting the individuals in the first place. One of the things that you'll notice from the video is that there were many, many officers who were looking out, and some of the soundtracks, even though the video and soundtracks are fairly poor, you'll hear shouting from the crowd, which the officers felt enough of a wariness that they're looking out into the crowd. Most of the officers aren't even looking towards the area where the individuals are trying to be controlled. So we don't know what brought this on or started it for one point. Not to make any judgments one way or the other at this point. That's well premature.
So when you think about your experience in use of force, there's been huge critiques of police departments across America for what is considered appropriate force, you know, whether it results in a shooting or simply a verbal altercation. Very often community members will say, well, why couldn't the police have done X? Where do police officers draw the line in response? How do you make a decision if for example, there is an altercation on a train? How do police departments teach what an appropriate response is?
Well, the police use of force is pretty well set down by one lead case, which is Graham versus Connor. And the standard is whether it's reasonable. And you have to understand that that includes everything that happens prior to, everything the officer knows, they're told on a radio, what the officer sees, hears, even what they smell. If they smell alcohol or observe something about the individual that indicates drug use, it heightens the level of awareness that the officer has to use. And it's really not a one-size-fits-all solution. Every situation is different.
But let's throw something else into the mix that happened here, which is a taser. The officer in question, the officer who fired the fatal shot, there's some indication he may have thought that he was pulling out a taser. Other people don't buy that theory. Regardless, what about the use of tasers? What kind of standards do officers face when they have a taser and have to decide when to use it?
Well, one of the things, I am a taser instructor, I have had a taser used on me, and I understand fully what the person having it used on them feels. As far as the use of a taser, I don't think that even is settled yet. The video is poor enough quality, and I don't think that's all the video that's available. This will be analyzed, and further video may come forward out of this. But you have to understand there's also a training response. The training response is the officer has made so many draws from a firearm, and under stress, that training response may control. They may think they're going for the taser and actually be drawing a firearm. That has happened in other jurisdictions. I'm not saying it's present in this case.
And this has to be quite brief, but what do you think is an officer's best defense against losing his or her head in a tense situation?
Proactive training and force-on-force training, where officers are put into a situation with role players who are willing to absorb impact and take the cost of the training situation so that an officer expands their comfort zone and has more options to deal with those who may be resistive.
All right. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That was Rocky Warren. He's a police use of force expert and a retired patrol sergeant for Placer County in the California Sheriff's Department. And coming up, we'll have more from our series, our month-long series on crime. This is NPR News. This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. What triggers someone to walk into a bank, pull out a gun, and demand money from a teller? Can psychological profiling tell us anything about a street corner hustler? What plays a bigger role, psychology or society? Our next guest spent a year working in a maximum security federal prison in Atlanta. He conducted everything from anger management counseling to pretrial psych assessments. His office was on the cell block. Ivory Toldson is now an assistant professor of counseling psychology at Howard University. Thanks for joining us, Ivory.
Thank you.
So what did you learn at this prison about criminal behavior and basically what takes people from thinking about crime, which I think plenty of people do, if only is a fantasy of, what if I got away with the money lying, in the street corner,
right.
to someone who really makes crime a way of life?
Yeah. Well, I learned quite a bit. And that the year that I worked at the Maximum Security Federal Penitentiary in Atlanta, one of my primary responsibilities was to administer an assessment called the psychopathy checklist. And psychopathy is a clinical diagnosis for someone who has a natural criminal disposition, someone who receives gratification out of a variety of criminal and risky lifestyle behaviors. And my dissertation was looking at the psychometric properties. When I say psychometric properties, I mean whether or not this test is a fit test, if it's appropriate to use, if it gets the kind of information that we needed to get for certain populations. And I did an assessment of this instrument on African-American male inmates. And what prompted me to do that particular study was because the instrument that we were using, the Hare Psychopathy Checklist, was originally normed on the Canadian inmate population that had very few African-Americans in it. I guess no African-Americans as we think of them in the United States, and maybe some Afro-Canadians. But it's widely used in the criminal justice system here in the United States. And so the risk with that, if you're giving an assessment to African-Americans, but the norm reference is white Americans, then there's certain risk involved with that.
So you think that there can be a question of whether or not even how we think about these criminal justice issues is reflective of racial differences. But that the whole idea of racial differences on any level has been one of the biggest bonfires of world culture, you know, whether
right.
there are physical differences, ethical differences, intellectual differences. What are you really looking for when you look at norming a test based on racial differences? I mean, isn't committing a crime just committing a crime?
Well, there are certain behaviors that may be normal in one culture, but indicative of something else in another culture. Certain tests measure behaviors that are related to crime, not the crime in and of itself. So, for instance, one of the items of the psychopathy checklist is heightened, grandiose sense of self. So someone who is very egotistical could have a score bumped up on this checklist. Now, the problem as it respects to race is if you have one culture where egotistical behavior may be associated with crime, but another culture where egotistical personas is something that is learned and adapted in that culture, and it may mean something else, something a lot less harmless, then that's when you get into those kinds of issues.
All right. When you think about where we are today in our society and faced with the economic challenges that arguably could squeeze more people into a life of crime,
mm-hmm.
What psychological factors combine with opportunity? I mean, there's
right.
some maybe the question is, are there some people who are criminally minded, just simply criminally minded, and other people who kind of have a tipping point where they will become criminals if there's certain things that go certain ways in their lives?
Right. And that's a good question, and something that's studied quite a bit. We can see with any race or our culture that the segment of that population that has the highest incidence of poverty also has more criminal behavior. And I think that we can use basic common sense to understand that there are certain survival mechanisms that come into play when someone is in a impoverished condition, and they may resort to crime as a means of survival. Not everyone in that same condition will respond in the same way. There are societal influences over criminal behavior, but there are also some people who are more likely to commit crime when faced with certain challenges. And so you can have two people you remove any social barriers, neither one of them will commit crime. But you take those same two people, place them in an adverse social condition, one of them might commit crime, the other one will find other ways. So it's a little bit of both.
Right. Now, the risk of young black men dying of homicide has increased 31% since 2002, mm-hmm. according to a recent study. And black men are disproportionately likely to be either the victim of a crime or the witness of a crime. What about the issue of post-traumatic stress disorder? Does this ever come up in really analyzing how people react to crime or even a reason why people may who are traumatized may feel like crime is normal?
Right. Yeah. And this is something that I just recently wrote about. I think one problem that we have in criminal psychology, among the criminal psychologists that's working with African Americans, we tend to rely very heavily on sociological literature to help us to understand black criminal behavior. And there are certain problems involved with this. One problem is that I think a lot of criminal psychologists operate under the assumption that young black men are inoculated to the effects of violence. And so you may have, white females, if they're a victim of violent crime, our society tends to take that very seriously. And, you know, I don't think it's anything very controversial what I'm saying. All you have to do is look at the news and see, like the Holloway case and things like that. When we have a white female victim, it gets a different type of coverage than a poor black male in the inner cities. And so we look at that. Criminal psychologists are looking at the same thing. People actually practice it. And so we miss the symptoms of post-traumatic stress in a lot of young black men. When you look at the numbers, young black men are more likely to be a victim of a violent crime, a victim or a witness to violent crime than any other race group in the United States. Yet they are very rarely diagnosed with post-traumatic stress. And post-traumatic stress can lead to avoidant behavior. It can lead to what may look like apathy. It could lead to a lot of anxious behavior, and untreated, it could also lead to more violent behavior.
Well, thank you so much. That was Ivory Toldson. He's an assistant professor of counseling psychology at Howard University and editor-in-chief of the Journal of Negro Education, and he joined us from NPR's headquarters in Washington, D.C. Do the crime, do the time. That's the old line, right? But convicted perpetrators are still afforded basic human rights while serving out their debt to society. The Southern Center for Human Rights recently filed suit on behalf of a group of prisoners in Decatur, Alabama. The presiding judge described the county jail as, quote, a slave ship. There, the sheriff is accused of starving his prisoners so he could pocket the profits off a lean kitchen budget. Joining us is Lisa Kung, the executive director of the Southern Center for Human Rights. Hi, Lisa.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. So this case has just stunned people across the world. I couldn't believe it myself when I read about it. But I understand that there's a Depression-era law on the books that made this kind of profiteering legal. Tell us about the law and the details of the case.
Sure, that's right. Alabama has this arrangement where the state pays $1.75 a day to the sheriffs, directly to the sheriffs, for every person they have in his or her jail. Now, you know, you and I know it's hard enough to come up with three meals a day for $1.75. And what makes Alabama special is that it allows these sheriffs to take any of the money that they don't spend on food and put it straight into their own pocket. So last week at the hearing in federal court about this, the sheriff was forced to tell the truth on the stand. And at the end of the day, the federal judge found the sheriff in contempt, turned to the United States Marshals, and told the marshals to take the sheriff into custody.
Now, taking the sheriff into custody is just, you know, something that probably the prisoners who were sitting around hungry feel is long overdue. But the sheriff issued a statement last week denying the allegations, and it reads, quote, "The Morgan County Jail served over 328,000 meals in 2008 and only received 15 complaints on the issue of food. That is a very low number, especially coming from a jail. I have never or would not ever have tolerated an inmate being fed inadequate portions or meals for any reason." So that's his statement. What do you expect to happen moving forward with him and with this case? Do you expect him to hold on to his job? Do you expect the law to be changed?
Well, the law, immediately after this happened, the sheriffs got around the state and said, look, we probably should have a go at changing this law. It would be embarrassing for all of us to be exposed for the kind of money we're taking into our pockets. The sheriff in Morgan County actually had a pretty good defense. It was his best defense. I wouldn't call it a good defense. His best defense was everybody does it. I mean, the food is terrible everywhere. But what really sunk him was when it was exposed, he had to admit that he had gotten this 18-wheeler truck full of corn dogs from a friend of his. Essentially, he and another sheriff split a 18-wheeler truckload full of corn dogs for $1,000, $500 a piece, and these are corn dogs that couldn't be sold anywhere else. And he had to tell the story of how he got these corn dogs essentially for free and then was able to feed the people in his jail breakfast, lunch, and dinner for 2 months on these corn dogs, and was somewhat proud of himself for having done this. And that's really what sunk him it was revealed, you know, this money went straight into his pocket. And last year he pocketed well over $95,000 while the people in his jail went hungry. And when this comes out, you know, the sheriffs around the state, this is happening all over the state, but they've been able to sort of operate in secret. They've refused to reveal how much money is being put in their own pocket. And so I think they're scrambling right now to try to save face, to try to do something to change the law. And we'll see what happens next year.
What are the ripple effects of this and the ramifications for other districts? Are there any other places, first of all, that have this law?
You know, we had thought that Alabama was unique in this way, but right after the story broke, we got a call from a sheriff in Indiana who said, look, this happens here all the time as well. I've chosen not to participate here. I feed my people a little bit better. And he was very adamant but that, you know, that this happens in other places, but that really should be changed because it's an embarrassment. It's an embarrassment to the sheriffs to be operating in this kind of system.
What do you think the value is to the conversation over prisoners' rights of having a case like this? I mean, on the one hand, it seems really outrageous, but on the other hand, it is one of these sunshine cases where there is some light that's been shown on a practice that most people never even knew about. So what kind of ripple effects do you expect it to have as people look in general on the broader level of what people convicted of crimes deserve? Because that's one of the things we're looking at in our series, is that just because you've been convicted of a crime doesn't mean that all of your rights are stripped away. So what remains and what should remain? Do you think this will help people dig into that issue a little bit more?
Sure. I think you've just a couple of points there. One is that what was happening here was in a jail. And jails are places where folks are going before they've been tried or convicted of anything. So these are overwhelmingly, you know, poor folks that can't make bond who are awaiting trial. But I think, you know, the thrust of your question is exactly right. What do we learn from this kind of case? We didn't learn anything by learning that prisoners are being fed crummy food. I think the lesson here is, you know, prisons and jails are these secretive places. They're walled off from public scrutiny. And the moment you sort of lift that secrecy and you have people actually describe what's going on, admit what's going on, it's shocking and it's embarrassing and it's not the sort of thing that we can tolerate in a free society. The food is one issue. The amount of violence, the kinds of disrespect, the poor medical care, these are the sort of larger issues that the moment you sort of you shine a light on those issues, it becomes very apparent that prisons and jails are places that need far, far more public scrutiny than they're afforded right now.
In terms of the idea of rehabilitating people or preparing them to go back into society, obviously jails are more transitional, but in terms of prisons, just your personal take on it, do you think that we're making any progress in really trying to deal with the issue of reentry into society?
Well, the prison system is one where it's befuddling why we don't demand more accountability. I mean, we would not tolerate any other public institution that makes things worse. Hospitals that make people sicker than they are. I mean, we wouldn't tolerate that sort of thing. If you look at the results of prison, prisons have not made us any safer. It's this big question of whether prisons rehabilitate people or not has been settled for a couple of hundred years. They certainly don't. The question of whether prisons or jails do anything for the crime rate has been settled. The answer is no. There's mm-hmm. no. There's essentially no correlation between the number of people in prisons and jails and the crime rate. It brings the basic question up: what is the point of having prisons?
All right, Lisa. Thank you.
Thank you.
That was Lisa Kung, the executive director of the Southern Center for Human Rights, and she joined us from Doppler Studios in Atlanta, Georgia. Next on News and Notes, finish out that senior year of college or jump straight into pro football. We'll talk about the NFL draft and more with our sports bloggers. You're listening to News and Notes from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. From the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. And from the Wallace Foundation, where arts and education leaders can learn about how to bring the arts to more people. Downloads at the Knowledge Center at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Growing up as a kid, Joseph Sadler looked at his father's vinyl records and wondered how they could make sounds.
I had always wondered, how does music live inside those little black tunnels?
What he learned helped him become one of hip-hop's pioneer DJs.
It's like a jungle sometimes. It makes me wonder how I keep from going under.
I'm Farai Chidea. The story of a living legend, Grandmaster Flash, next time on News and Notes. Broken glass everywhere. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. It's time now for a look at the week in sports with our own Tony Cox. Hey, Tony.
Hey, Farai. You know, playoffs, drafts, retirements, leaves of absence. Is this sports? I guess it is. Those are some of the subjects we're going to tackle in this week's Bloggers Roundtable. And to join me to do all of that, we have Kevin Figures. He writes the blog for sports station AM570Radio.com here in L.A. And Karen Phillips blogs at themavenreport.com down in Atlanta. Gentlemen, Nice to have you back.
Good to be here, Tony.
What's going on, Tony?
Let's talk about this first. Today, the deadline for all college football players wanting to toss their names into the NFL draft. And sure enough, aspiring pros have been coming out of the woodwork all week long, including today. Of course, in football, a good quarterback is always the prize of the draft. And this year, there were interesting prospects at the QB position, to say the least. Tim Tebow, Florida. Matthew Stafford, Georgia. Sam Bradford, Oklahoma. Mark Sanchez, USC. Nate Davis, Ball State. And Colt McCoy, Texas. Kevin, it looks like only Sanchez and Davis are going to jump to the pros.
That's the way it's looking right now. Bradford's already said he's coming back. At the Florida rally, Tim Tebow said he was going to come back, which I think is the best option for him. I don't think he's going to be a first-round quarterback. He might not even be a first-day player drafted. So I think that's the best decision for him. Matt Stafford, I don't think he's decided yet where he wants to go or where he wants to stay. I think as far as being a pure pro prospect, he's probably the best one coming out of all the quarterbacks available to enter into.
Now, Karen, you know, how good a draft class do you think this is, number one? And number two, do you think that the decisions that we've seen so far by the players on whether they will stay or go, have those been the right ones, the right decisions?
As a class as a whole, I'm not sure yet. I know I just found out that Stafford, him and Moreno are going from UGA. So the quarterbacks, it's kind of up in the air. Some of the best guys are staying, like Bradford and Tebow. But as a whole, I'm not too sure yet. The underclassmen like Crabtree and Macklin coming out, those guys are pretty good. I think they're ready for the pros right now. But as a whole, I wouldn't be ready to give the class a specific grade right now. But I think most of the guys have made good decisions in terms of like Bradford and especially Tebow coming back for one more year.
Who do you think should be number one, Kevin? Who do you think will be number one?
The number one overall pick or the number one quarterback?
Number one overall and then the number one quarterback.
Number one overall pick? I'm not sure. All the prognosticators have come out. The offensive tackle from Alabama, whose name is slipping me right now, who got suspended for the Sugar Bowl, actually. I forget his name. He's actually a good prospect. A lot of people have him ranked high as one of the top players taken. Stafford is actually up there as one of the best quarterback prospects, one of the best overall prospects coming out of the draft. So I'm probably gonna think it's gonna be either one of those two, either the Alabama offensive tackle or Matthew Stafford if he comes out.
What about quarterback? You think he would be the number one?
I think he would be the top quarterback taken
over Sanchez.
I think over Sanchez. I think he has, as far as pure intangibles, and like a lot of these general managers like to draft off of intangibles and you know, what they can do for you in the future. I think Stafford has a bigger upside than Sanchez does in the pros.
All right, we'll find out. One other thing before we move on, Karen, is this. USC's defense could produce two top 10 picks and four top 20 picks, but a lot has been made of the decision by Taylor Mays, their top defensive player, All-American safety, to stay in school another year. I guess that's good news for Pete Carroll and USC, wouldn't you think?
Oh, I know Pete Carroll has to be ecstatic. I expected Taylor Mays to go. I expected him to be a first-round pick, first-day pick. With him coming back, it just gives his defense a little more help because I know a lot of those guys are going. But it's USC. Pete Carroll stays loaded out there on the West Coast, so he should be ranked either in the top three when polls come out.
One more thing, Kevin, about the college football draft is this. When you look back on some recent drafts, including Matt Leinart, Vince Young, both who were superstars in college, not so much in the NFL so far for either one of them, actually. What does that say about the quality of quarterbacks coming out of college? And, you know, who's overrated, do you think?
Oh, there's plenty of overrated. Another example you can maybe use is Jamarcus Russell, who's still young and he's still starting with the Oakland Raiders.
Yep.
That a lot of these general managers, as I said, draft off of intangibles and not what a player can actually do. Matt Leinart was in a situation at USC where he played with so much talent, it was hard for any quarterback who was halfway decent to not succeed. Vince Young played in a gimmick system at Texas where he was able to do whatever he wanted to, and he found out in the pros that he's not able to do that. So it just comes down to the NFL is a different type of game than college football. You're not going to have a loaded team around you all the time where you're gonna have plays to dump off to Reggie Bush from 5 yards in the flat and he can make plays downfield. Reggie Bush is not a quarterback, but he's also a player that came out and has also struggled in the NFL.
True.
So a great college player does not always translate to a great NFL player, and a lot of these general managers don't know that for some reason.
Well, they find out pretty quickly,
don't
they?
Yes, they do.
Absolutely. All right, guys, let's move on to one more thing. I want to go back to the BCS championship game and the controversy. Florida, Karen, number one in BCS, but a lot of folks are claiming that they don't deserve the outright title, even President-elect Obama. Here is the new president.
Congratulations to Florida. I have to point out, if I'm Utah, if I'm USC or if I'm Texas, I may still have some quibbles. You've heard my pitch. That's why we need a playoff.
Yeah, but it ain't going to happen, is it, Kyron? Not with ESPN involved.
It's not going to happen. Much as I love the president-elect, I have to disagree with him. The only people I think who have an argument are Texas, because they did beat Oklahoma, and I do believe that should have been a national title game, Texas-Florida. But Utah does have a strong case. They are the only 13-0 team in the country. I had a feeling going into the Alabama game they were going to win. I just wish some kind of way it could have been Utah, Texas, or Florida to figure that thing out at the end of the season.
Well, good thing you're on the east side of the Mississippi River, because on this side of the Mississippi River, people are saying USC should have been involved.
Not a chance. Oregon State proved it to everybody. The two Rogers brothers, they exposed USC that Thursday night on ESPN. I sat there and watched the game. USC, I'm sorry, they did not deserve it. They do it every year.
We don't have enough time to have this argument. I'm going to have you on in a couple of weeks. Let's move on to the NFL. Perhaps the biggest football news of the week, Kevin, though not a total surprise, has to do with the Indianapolis Colts. Coach Tony Dungy stepping down, the only black coach to ever win a Super Bowl. So I'm not clear, what do you think his legacy is? I mean, a lot has been made about him, about the fine person he is, the fine coach that he's been. His record has been good at Indianapolis, but they haven't won that. They only won the big one one time.
Very true. They've only won the big one time. They've been the favorites more often than not. I think you have to look at Tony Dungy's coaching career as a whole and where he came from, as taking the Vikings defense and doing a great job with them, going to a dead Tampa Bay franchise that was actually a sieve. Nobody cared. They were one of the worst franchises in sports. Took them and turned them into a perennial playoff power, got them to the NFC title game, and they were probably a bad call away from going to the Super Bowl that year with the whole, you know, Ben Emmanuel catch and all of that. So I think Tony Dungy goes down as one of the greatest coaches of all time. The other thing is, the only coach in NFL history to have to go to the playoffs 10 consecutive seasons. That has to say something, you know. And he's always been competitive. He's never, you know, I think he's bowed out once in the playoffs with Indianapolis. He got embarrassed by the Jets one year. But his teams are always competitive. His teams always played hard for him. No player has ever complained about him. I think he's one of the greatest coaches of all time. I think he's a Hall of Famer.
A lot has been made, Kyron, about the fact that there aren't enough black head football coaches in college. But although there are more now in the NFL, Dungy being one of them, what's unusual, I think, is that Dungy's being replaced by another African-American. You don't usually have one black head coach replaced by another, do you?
Not necessarily. This one was a rare case with Jim Caldwell coming in. It's good to see another black face with a head coaching position on the sidelines in the NFL. But like, the problem still remains, like you said, Tony, in college football, in the NFL, we don't have enough. We need more. That's why the Rooney Rule is in effect. We need more black head coaches on these sidelines.
Now, in the NFL playoffs coming up this weekend, Eagles versus Cardinals and the Steelers versus the Ravens. Who do you like, Kevin?
I like the Eagles. I like to be the Eagles and the Steelers. I think the Ravens' defense is playing well. Their offense is okay. But when it comes down to it, it comes down to whose offense can make more plays. I think the Steelers' offense has a chance to make more plays against the Ravens' defense than the other way around. And the Eagles embarrassed the Cardinals earlier this year on Thanksgiving Day. I think it's going to be more of the same this week.
Billy, you think that same way, Kyron?
No, I think the Steelers and the Cardinals. But first of all, I have to apologize to Donovan McNabb, because last time I was on here, I said his career was over in Philly. But he proved me wrong.
He proved you wrong.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
He's doing this thing out in Philadelphia. But I'm going with the Cardinals. They've been proving everybody wrong so far. Bolden's coming back. Breston and Fitzgerald are having monster years. And I think Kurt Warner still has a little bit left in the tank. And they have the running game going with Edgerrin James.
I like the Cardinals, too. Kurt Warner seems to be on a mission this year. Let's switch to Major League Baseball, guys. The Hall of Fame announcing its latest inductees, among them Ricky Henderson, Jim Rice. Now, Kevin, Ricky Henderson was a first ballot selection, although 28 writers did not vote for him. This guy's an all-time steals leader in baseball, played effectively into his 40s. Controversial, sure, but come on. How could he not be a unanimous first ballot choice?
The greatest leadoff hitter of all time, most people will tell you. How you can be the greatest anything of all time and not be a unanimous, or at least close to unanimous? How can you be one of the 28? I don't know how you sleep at night being one of the 28 who doesn't vote him to be in the Hall of Fame. How could you not? A lot of these guys are just stubborn to where they just They just don't want anybody to be a first ballot. I don't know why. I don't know why it's such a big deal to them, but they don't want anybody to be unanimous, and I don't see what the big issue is. Ricky Henderson is one of the greatest baseball players of all time. You can say he's kooky or he's you know, whatever, but he was a great baseball player.
Absolutely.
That's all that should matter.
Absolutely. And now, on the other hand, Karen, Jim Rice got in finally on his 15th and last try. My question is, why are the sports writers who vote for the Hall of Fame allowed to do so anonymously? Do you think that's right?
No, I think they should put their first and last names and government names and all that on the ballot list. I think these players should know who's voting and who shouldn't, because with Jim Rice's, in his case, he should have been in the Hall of Fame. We should know these 28 voters who didn't vote Ricky Henderson in, because that's a shame. He's Ricky Henderson. It's Ricky being Ricky. This guy's numbers are no one's better than his. First, you look at his numbers, he's first in almost everything he's ever done.
That's true.
And but he was, 44, 45 out there still stealing bases?
Still stealing bases, absolutely.
I mean, this guy, it shouldn't even been a vote for Ricky Henderson.
Absolutely.
They should have just gave him the jersey and sent him to Cooperstown. No application needed.
Here's a young guy, we're going to move to college basketball, who is going to be in the, at least at the college ranks at the University of Kentucky, in their Hall of Fame, and who knows what's going to be in his career later on. Karan, I'm talking about Jody Meeks. I don't know if you guys got to see him in the game Kentucky against Tennessee. He went off for 54 points. It was an amazing college performance, wasn't it?
I didn't actually see the game. I saw the highlights, though. 14-14 from the free throw line, 10-15 from the three-point line, and he scored 54, only shooting 22 times. People may not think that's a lot after Kobe scored 81 for the Lakers a couple of years back, but you have to remember, in college, it's a 35-second shot clock, so that's less possessions. There's less times for your team to have the ball and less opportunities for you to score. So 54 in a college game where you can play a true zone defense against a man, that's a lot. That is a great number.
Absolutely. He broke Dan Issel's scoring record, which was set in 1970. I guess this puts him in the conversation with player of the year possibilities, Kevin, right?
He's been good all year long. You know, he has good numbers. I think he's one of the top scorers in the SEC. Player of the year honors, I'm not sure. I don't think he's going to pass up Blake Griffin from Oklahoma or players like that with this one performance. It definitely put his name on the map for people who didn't know who Jody Meeks was. Anybody that watched Kentucky has known the last couple of years how good of a player that he actually is. But it was an amazing performance from what he did. You rarely ever see that in college basketball, where the court is so compact and the defense is so, is like you said, the zone defense is so good. You rarely ever see that kind of scoring performance in college basketball.
All right, let's end the sports bloggers on this topic. We've got about 30 seconds or so. Charles Barkley, he said he's not a role model now that he's been arrested again, talking about alcohol and his, shall we say, sexual escapades. I guess he's right. He ain't a role model, is he, Kyron?
He said he wasn't a role model. He isn't one, but we need Charles back on the air. He made the right decision, but I'll be happy to see him back on TNT in a couple of weeks.
People are missing him. The show's not the same without him, is it, Kevin?
No, not even. No, Charles makes that show. I like Kenny and those guys, but Charles is the face of that show.
He just needs to behave himself.
Mm-hmm.
All right, gentlemen, I appreciate you coming on. Kyron Phillips blogs at themavenreport.com, joining us from Georgia Public Broadcasting in Atlanta. And Kevin Figures writes the blog for sports station AM 570 Radio. He joined us right here in our studios at NPR West.
And now it's letter time. Our editor, Sasha Woodruff, is here with me. Hey, Sasha.
Hey, Fry. How's it going?
I'm doing well. What are folks saying this week?
Well, we got a lot of letters about an interview with a couple who pledged to buy only from Black-owned businesses for 1 year. They're calling it the Ebony Experience. Tom O'Neill sent us this. I enjoy your show very much, but this particular segment disturbed me. When does selecting service providers based solely on race and or choosing not to do business with a company based on the race of the owner cross the line between supporting a community and race-based discrimination?
Then Damon Thomas wrote to us on our website and argued that the Ebony experiment would provide greater service to the Black community if, instead of doing business themselves exclusively with Black-owned companies, they would make an equal effort to introduce non-Black friends and associates to Black-owned businesses.
Then Christian Kirby in Baltimore, Maryland, wrote us this about an interview with a Sidwell Friends School alum. That's the school that Sasha and Malia Obama are attending in D.C. Christian wrote, I listened with interest to your conversation with Sidwell alumna Damali Ayo. Mrs. Ayo's statements about the school are accurate. Its occasional missteps on the path to racial equality notwithstanding, it certainly has its heart in the right place. The Obama girls will be challenged, respected, and loved. I wish them the best, and I thank News and Notes for pursuing the story.
And finally, Ibrahim Siddiq in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia, wrote us about a show this week that included an interview with a woman who set out to find her adoptive family in Eritrea. He wrote, "The interview with Hannah Poole demonstrated a multidimensional potential to explore other experiences from around the world, not just in America or just among African Americans. Secondly, the interview with the Black publishers was inspiring. Haki Madhubuti's contribution brought back memories of my years in undergraduate school when he was one of the more prominent Black poets of the time. Thank you, News and Notes."
And thank you for your letters. Please keep your thoughts coming over the next few months.
To write to us, just log on to npr.org and click on Contact Us. When you get there, you'll see lots of shows to choose from. Make sure you pick News and Notes when you write to us.
And be sure to tell us where you're writing from and how to pronounce your name.
Thanks, Sasha.
No problem.